brought to you by your IEC Advocacy Committee. In the year 2008, appropriate AIDS drugs are not accessible for all people. This is especially true as you look at the newer, more effective, and easier to take medications. Generic manufacturers are the least expensive way to bring these medicines to market, and when large pharmaceutical companies apply patents, which mean generic companies can't produce them, drugs are inaccessible. As you came in today, you received a one-page handout on this campaign effort being spearheaded by the churches in German. You also received a postcard. Read the one-pager, sign the postcard, and drop it in the buckets on the way out of your doors. See Astrid if you need further details. And Astrid is the moderator for this plenary session, so you'll all know who she is by the end of this afternoon. We hope you will advocate with the pharmaceutical company next week during the conference about how much they are responding to this issue. And lastly, don't forget to join us on Sunday for the March for Access to Medicines before the opening of the IAC event. Meet at 3 p.m. at the U.S. Embassy near the Angel of Independence. Thank you. So now we're ready to begin the next and final plenary session for today, and I'll turn the program over to the moderator, Astrid.
Thank you, Karen. I'd like to welcome you all to this session on stigma and discrimination. About 3 weeks ago, the BBC posted up a question on the internet. Is being HIV positive a stigma in your country? There were about 142 responses from all over the world, and I would like to read you a few of them. There was Lubna from Iraq who wrote, "Actually, if you were HIV positive and living in Iraq, then you'd better dig yourself a grave and bury yourself in it for good. HIV positive in Iraq is unfortunately a disgrace and a source of huge shame to the person, him or herself, and to the family." Another response was by Brenda from Uganda. "An HIV positive person is likely to suffer extreme social stigmatization in rural areas, because the community believes it is a disease for sexual deviants." There's Katerina from Austria who wrote, "In Austria, being HIV positive is still a big stigma, regardless of what the media and politicians tell you." And the final one I want to read out is from Muti Mwangi in Kenya. "In Kenya, it is not a good idea to broadcast to everyone that you are HIV positive." Now, this is not 1985. This was posted on the 9th of July, 2008. There's still a lot of stigma attached to being HIV positive, despite the fact that we know a lot about this virus, that we know exactly how it is transmitted and how we can protect ourselves, and that we know that there is lifelong treatment and that AIDS is manageable. So why? Why does stigma persist? Has it to do with the fact that society at large, communities, health centres, families tend to jump to conclusions about how people got infected and how they might be a danger to others now? And what are we doing about this? We as civil society, we as churches, as people of faith, are we speaking out against this injustice that people living with HIV have to face? What can we do in practical terms to reduce stigma? I'm excited to introduce to you three outstanding panelists from three different continents or subcontinents who've been actively engaged in the fight against HIV and in the fight against stigma for many, many years. The three panelists are Maestro Emilio Alvarez Icaza from Mexico, Sophie Dilmitis from Zimbabwe, and Bishop Mark Hansen from North America. I would like to give the floor now to Maestro Emilio Alvarez Icaza. He's a sociologist by training. He's been involved in the human rights movement in Mexico for 20 years, and since 2001 he's the president of the Commission on Human Rights. Emilio, the floor is yours.
Muy buenas tardes.
Good afternoon. As you can see, I'm going to speak in Spanish. As an act of multiculturality, and also because this is my country, I want to welcome you to Mexico. It's a pleasure to have you here. It's a privilege that brothers and sisters from around the world are coming to our city, a wonderful city, a complex city that has a lot of empathy towards the ecumenical movement. And we have empathy because we have a saying in this city that Mexico City is the city of believers. And it's a city of believers because only God knows how many people live here. We don't know if we're 21, 22 million, and what we add up this week. It's a place that needs a lot of faith. And that is why it's a great joy for our city to have all of this hope and all of this strength, because the people that are here today are builders of hope. In a subject or a topic that's so difficult and so painful as HIV/AIDS is, because the most critical aspect of this topic is that HIV does not discriminate. HIV/AIDS can attack anyone, men, women, the elderly, children, rich, poor. But as it happens many times with discrimination, it goes more to people that are vulnerable, or the people that society puts at risk, those that have a bad economic situation, or those who have also lived discrimination and exclusion in other aspects. And we have built social lies that make this stigma and discrimination even more crude. And that is why it's so important for us to have clarity that facing the non-discrimination of AIDS, we have to generate a similar action of non-discrimination when it comes to building hope. And if someone can do that, it's especially the people that have faith. And we have to place in the center of this human dignity and the principle of equality for everyone as the main element to fight against discrimination. This subject brings a lot of pain. When we ask ourselves what's going on, figures can go up and down, but last year, an average 6,300 people died of AIDS every day, which is almost 300 per hour, which is a really shocking figure. And this is when it actually takes form, the problem takes form. So an activist was telling me, an HIV/AIDS activist was telling me that this is the most radical movement of all. And he was telling me, Emilio, we are losing our lives to it. And a lot of us remember friends that have lost their lives in this struggle. And we can give names to these people. That is why it's very literal that we are giving our lives to creating this faith and hope. So looking at the HIV/AIDS problem from that point of view, it has from its origin a stigma that has gone from the beginning and that is becoming more crude, and it's becoming one of the most important obstacles because it affects specifically the exercise of human rights, and that is what I specifically want to talk about. The problem is not only of judicial or legal equality. That discussion, apparently we've won that discussion, but what this is about is about the condition that a lot of people are living in because they cannot exercise their human rights equally, because there is a condition under the stigma and the discrimination that affects this exercise of their human rights. And what we see as something that we have to understand is that stigma and discrimination are actually even more devastating than the disease itself. The cost is even higher, because those social relationships are made cruder when poverty and the effect that it has on the gay or homosexual and lesbian community or young people. So in reality, the problem that we have is that stigma and discrimination has even more devastating effects than the disease and that affects directly the exercise of their human rights. And so that leads us to understand, from a broader perspective, the understanding of human rights. Not only because human rights are an obligation of states, but also because it has a co-responsibility social aspect, because that discrimination is something that we do not see, but that is there. And what is even worse is that we see it as normal. It seems as though it's a horrible normality, where it's normal to discriminate against women, to beat her, to have that she has less access to medicines, where there's people that, because of their sexual preference, are fired or they lose their access to medical treatment, and for example they do not have access to antiretrovirals, which leads to their death, because it's normal that children do not have a choice, and a lot of times have problems of sexual exploitation and child abuse. So especially the human rights fight has to go against this perverse normality, and we have to know that it's not normal to discriminate, that it goes against not only the human dignity principle that is about the human rights of people, because that's what the focus that we have to put in the middle. The human rights are not the citizens. Human rights are for people, and that's something that's very important for states to notice. So today we see around the world that governments are mistaken about what they think the subject of human rights are. In Europe, there was a great there was a program that was approved when it comes to migration. Mexico has a great problem with immigration. The United States, in Mexico, we give worse treatment to people coming from Latin America and from Central America than to Mexicans. So Mexico is being very incongruent, because we do not give a good treatment to those coming from Central America. And that happens because the government thinks that those who are subject to human rights are citizens instead of people. And that is something that we have to recover in this battle for human rights. Actually, that's what the Universal Declaration says. This December, it's going to turn 60 years old. And if we look at this declaration, we see that the subject is human beings, it's people. It doesn't say citizens. So the problem that we have is that the category of the exercise of these rights is the person, the people, and the actions of the states has to do with the category of citizens. And that is why there is a great gap. And that's why we have to have a process to build a bridge to that, to give rights to people and give them these rights without distinction or without making distinction of anything. So that's why we have to start facing different aspects, because this society a lot of times does not want to treat causes without finding those who are guilty. So we start looking for who's to blame, and we reproduce those stereotypes. And a lot of times in countries like ours, in Mexico, with this very strong Catholic background, the guilt is very important, because then we're always trying to find who's to blame. So we're reproducing a series of social buildings that have been very painful. This is a disease only for homosexuals, or this is a problem that only exists in Africa, or this is a problem only for certain people, and we start reproducing a lot of discrimination, and we cannot understand, for example, the importance or the need of building a practice of sexual rights or reproducing rights. So this first generation from the 60s and 70s, it's the first time in the history of humanity where we see the separation between sexual rights and reproductive rights. So we are looking at safe sex and why it's important to talk to our children about safe sex as a right, and then public health policies, and then actions that can prevent these diseases, and actions by the state, by the government, to give out condoms or other protection mechanisms, so that we can see the responsibility of government from law. So this is a question that we have to The question that we have to ask ourselves from human rights is not if this is good or bad, or if I agree or disagree. The fact is, do we have a right or don't we have a right? And according to that, we have to create actions that can protect people from the risk that they are exposed to. And this necessarily happens because we have to understand this is a public health issue, as an education issue, and generate the mechanisms that can go towards building citizenship. And in this building of citizenship, we can join the idea of democracy as a system to exercise rights, and not only as a system to elect governments. Sometimes very expensive and not very functional. In 2006, there was an electoral conflict that was very important here in Mexico. And we had very high expenditures in the elections, in the political parties and the administrative authorities. And I'm not talking about private resources. $2,500 million we spent in 2006, and if we look at the product, it wasn't very good because we had a polarized country that we are still trying to overcome that conflict. So that's why you have to see democracy as something further, as a system that has to do with the exercising of rights of everyone in every different aspect of society, and generate conditions that can allow us to overcome stigma and discrimination. There are several instruments that are very powerful that we have to appeal to. And our countries have signed these agreements and they have become obligations of the states. We have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the International Pact of Civil and Political Rights, the International Pact of Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. And here we must also note the right to public health. It's not only health as in not getting sick, but it's health as the best possible state of physical and mental health, and that has to do with an action that is very important towards prevention. It has to do with the elimination of every form of discrimination of women, of the Children's Convention, the Declaration of Dubai, and that is where we can give this focus to human rights, because it provides a challenge to us because we're limiting the right to have dignity, because there's people that because they're HIV positive, even medical staff does not want to give them care, or for example the right to equality. When we see in this country there's a very vivid discussion about how much we spend in drugs. If Mexico had agreed to the strategic fund of the Pan American Health Fund, we could have saved a lot of money, but laboratories did not want to sell to Mexico through the Pan American Health Organization. And what does that mean? That less people can have access to medical treatment. The cost of the laboratory's position means $50 million for Mexico. So what we're saying is, there we have the example of Brazil. We need to guarantee as the right to health care and the position of the state, because throughout the criteria that the organisms have with the World Bank, we say that Mexico is a medium economy, but we cannot. This figure does not allow us to understand that in Mexico, half of the people live in poverty, and this kind of decisions affect the poor people even more, and that gives a public expenditure that cannot be covered. So that's why you have to see the right of non-discrimination and the focus of access to public services, because human rights also has to do with that, because what we think is most important about the government, which is having respect for their people and care for the people, especially when it comes to those who are in a greater risk. And what does this dilemma mean? It means that we have to understand that HIV carriers are not objects of law, they're subjects of law. And because they are subjects, through the logic of participation in building, they have the capacity and they're in the condition of facing these challenges. And I would like to end with this. If someone has that ability or capacity to provoke this as the theme of the conference is, action now, that is the churches. For churches, a lot of times the subject is people. For a lot of churches, the approach has to be from love, from solidarity, and from fraternity. And from that point, we have to build the example of the institutional action of churches to generate programs that have the capacity of making strategic alliances with the civil society and with different actors, including laboratories. Churches have to make an ethical stand of what's going on when it comes to human rights. That is the dilemma. 40 years ago in Latin America, talking about human rights was even dangerous. Maybe today it still is, but a lot less. It was subversive, it was communistic, it was problematic. Why is it not the same way today? And you can invite someone that works in human rights in Mexico to speak to you. And I think that happened because human rights won the battle of the ideas. We won the ideological battle. And why did we win? Because it was an ethical triumph. Because power cannot be exercised with abuse. We have to stop that abuse. Not because human rights can win elections or fill public places, but because it's an ethical triumph that puts in the middle of it the dignity of people. In the second half of the 20th century, we created so many judicial or legal instruments as we had never seen before in the history of humanity. We cannot see it now because it's too close. We might be blind to those advances because it's too close to us, but we can see that there has been a change that had never been seen in the history of humanity because we had never built or created so many instruments to defend the human dignity, and that is an ethical triumph. And if someone can know about this, or churches, if someone has the capacity or the ability to build hope in the middle of desolation and in the middle of a disease that is not fully comprehended, it's churches. So that's why it's so important that in the speeches coming from the churches, we have to include the perspective of human rights, and from there create the conditions to create the kingdom and faith here and now. And that is why we need action now. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Emilio. You've raised a lot of issues: the individual rights of every person, the political rights, the framework conditions that we need to change. And I think there's a lot of questions that might come up later in discussion. But we'd like to move on now to our next speaker, Sophie Dilmitis. Sophie is HIV and AIDS coordinator for the World YWCA. She's also a European regional representative of the international community of women living with HIV and AIDS. In the past, Sophie has been involved in assisting young positive people to develop their own organization and youth prevention programs, and she ran a weekly column in the Sunday Mirror in Harare on issues related to HIV and AIDS and how they were meant to fuel discussion on the issues. Sophie, we look forward to hearing about your rich experience in the field of HIV and AIDS and what type of relationship religious leaders should have with people living with HIV. Thank you.
Linda had promised me that she was going to have a step here. Last World AIDS Day, I spent the evening in a little parish in Strømmen in Norway. I was invited to this church to speak about HIV, and before I knew it, I was standing behind the pulpit. People living with HIV and drug users were part of the congregation. It was a very cold night, and they did not come because there was anything material on offer. They came because this was the only place that was offering them any kind of spiritual and emotional support. It was in this church that my faith in the power of religious leaders was restored. I wanted to clone this church and the people in it. The energy of acceptance and love I felt there was godly, and this is how relationships should be between people living with HIV and religious leaders. It is a great honor for me to participate in this plenary session on stigma and discrimination. As a person who has been living with HIV for 14 years, I know how important this topic is. I know how acceptance and love can grow health, economies, and leaders, and how stigma and discrimination caused by fear creates isolation and even death. We know this for a fact, as in some countries that have high prevalence rates, it is not that treatment is not available, but that people are not coming forward to access it, and this is because of associated stigma. The theme of this conference is Faith in Action Now. Religious leaders and faith-based organizations play a vital role, where sometimes actions speak louder than words, and words that are so powerful can make or break a person's life. So what is it that makes one infected person lead a responsible, healthy, productive life, and another not? And by this I mean, what makes one person get tested, accept their status, and do something about it, and be proactive about their health, and another not? As an HIV-positive person, I have the potential to infect many people each year, but I choose not to. You may wonder where I'm going with all of this, as my presentation is supposed to be on the relationships religious leaders have with people living with HIV. But please bear with me, because I often hear so many organizations saying that they really do want to partner with people living with HIV. It's just that these people are not disclosing. So how do they move forward? Well, I guess we need to stop and ask ourselves why someone should disclose their status if they only experience alienation, if there is no treatment, care and support, and if there is nothing to gain, especially if they belong to a congregation that for so many reasons never mentions HIV or speaks out about tough issues like gender inequality and male responsibility. Many times, it is only through relationships of any kind that we grow as individuals. And for this reason, relationships between people living with HIV and religious leaders are crucial. Imagine a church where you could say, I'm HIV positive. And the response was, so what? It's okay. We love you, and we're here for you, and we're all going to die one day anyway, and how you got infected really just isn't important. The fact is that this is here, so let's deal with it together. Imagine a world with no stigma. More than half the challenge would be won. A change in attitudes and perceptions would allow people to live and die with love and dignity. And this would lessen the shame and guilt felt by millions of people dying of AIDS today. If there was no stigma around HIV, there would be less fear. And if there was less fear, there would be less ignorance. And if there was less ignorance, there'd be less denial. All of this would contribute to fewer HIV infections. And there is nothing more frightening than ignorance in action. Religious leaders hold the key to doing away with shame and guilt that destroy immune systems and fight back viruses like stigma and silence. Religious leaders have immense power. Imagine the Pope, the Archbishop of Canterbury, a presiding bishop, or a leader from a megachurch speaking out on proven prevention methods such as condoms as life-saving devices. Imagine the impact that this would have. When we see religious leaders standing up and addressing these tough and very important issues, things will begin to shift. We have to recognize these opportunities to work together. Religious leaders have the responsibility to challenge other leaders, to take risks, to form these kinds of relationships, and stand in solidarity with people living with HIV. This is part of what being Christian means. One example of stigma-related advocacy that religious leaders could be taking up strongly is around travel restrictions, countries that restrict access to people living with HIV. Of course, we also have to recognize that stereotyping goes both ways, and many times it is people living with HIV that often don't want to work with religious leaders because there is a perception that all people of faith, and especially religious leaders, are conservative and judgmental. And positive networks have to move beyond this. We have spent 25 years addressing HIV. We are smarter in how we live with it. We are better educated about the behavior of the virus, more skilled in how we prevent it, and we appreciate more the role of leadership in social change and HIV management. Yet we lack one critical component if we are to succeed and to go into the future with integrity. We must come to terms with the moral issues that prevent us from making unprecedented progress. Partnerships between people living with HIV and religious leaders will bridge issues around morality, as HIV is so much more than just a health issue, but it touches on assumed promiscuity, homosexuality, drug use, and sex work. And in many countries, just being a woman is dangerous. We also need to recognize that there are so many people in the church that have already disclosed their HIV status. And we cannot underestimate how important this is, especially the work of Innerella and other networks, in breaking down some of the misconceptions about who is at risk. If we are going to overcome this pandemic, it will take a united front, a country, a continent, and a globe standing in unity and strength. Of course, all work begins by assessing our own values and perceptions. And we start by looking at our own lives and assessing. This kind of assessment must never cease. The actions we take today create the future. And for this reason, the World YWCA created the Nairobi 2007 Call to Action, which is centered around 10 key areas where personal commitment and leadership is required by all of us. If you don't already have a copy of this, please see us after this. So to conclude, I want to highlight 4 points on how relationships between religious leaders and people living with HIV should be built. The first is to speak out about HIV. Many religious leaders say that they don't address HIV because in some countries, the rates are so low. In cases like this, I urge you, I really urge you to move beyond the numbers, but see the people. Where many have supportive structures, many people still live in complete isolation. As you stand at the pulpit, recognize the power that you have in a captive audience. If you're not comfortable doing this, bring in somebody who can do this. Bring in somebody who is comfortable talking about sex and sexuality. And this involvement should be meaningful and not tokenistic and not just a one-off event. The second is acceptance, empathy, and understanding. When similar values are not shared, respecting different opinions is critical. Sometimes people living with HIV are not as understanding when prevention messages don't reflect our reality. Exclusion of any persons, whether based on religion, gender, sexual orientation, lifestyle, and HIV status, I believe, is contrary to the will of God. The third is that we must acknowledge that stigma in many times is towards people of faith. And as I said, HIV positive people and networks need to move beyond this so that we build relationships with religious leaders that strive to build on bridges of understanding. And last but not least, religious leaders need to become well-versed in the language of HIV and have developed knowledge, well-developed comprehensive knowledge around HIV. Millions have died, and millions continue to die, and I cannot think of a better reason for religious leaders to speak out openly and honestly about HIV in partnership with people living with HIV. The cost of not doing this and not building these kinds of relationships will be a failure and will shame the achievements of the last 25 years of AIDS. And we simply cannot afford this. The next 25 years will need partnerships and leaders who can go where sometimes only angels have dared.
Thank you very much, Sophie, for sharing your personal experience and for challenging the churches and the religious leaders. I think you've already thrown the ball to Bishop Hansen. Bishop Hansen, I don't think I really need to introduce yourself. I guess everyone here knows you already. Bishop Hansen is the president of the Lutheran World Federation. The Lutheran World Federation represents almost 70 million Christians. He's also the presiding bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Bishop Hansen is well known and respected internationally as an outspoken church leader in the struggle against HIV and AIDS. He has made public his own commitment to keep the promises that he has made as a church leader and to ensure that the institution he represents do so as well. Sophie has challenged churches and church leaders, religious leaders, to respond better to HIV with more empathy for people living with HIV and AIDS. And we look forward to hearing your response now, Bishop Hansen. Thank you.
After hearing Sophie's powerful testimony, and that of Herlin's this morning, there is really only one way I, as a global religious leader, can begin with integrity. So I would like to ask Herlin to come and join Sophie on the stage as I, on behalf of all religious leaders in the world, engage in an act of repentance and humility by washing their feet. I am absolutely convinced that we as religious leaders and we in the religious community have so shunned and shamed people with HIV and struggling with AIDS that we must begin first by engaging in public acts of repentance. Because absent public acts of repentance, I fear our words will not be trusted. Jesus, on the night before his death, washed his disciples' feet and instructed them to do the same as a reminder that we who bear the mark of his death on our brows are called to be a servant people. A public act is what I believe religious leaders have been challenged by Sophie and called by so many of you to engage in. Not just foot washing, not only acts of repentance, but public acts of being willing to be tested, public acts of advocacy and accompaniment, public acts of welcoming persons with HIV into full participation and leadership in our religious communities. I don't know about you, but I'm weary of religious leaders and people speaking of folks with HIV only as objects of our compassion and care and advocacy, rather than as full members and participants and leaders in religious communities. Years ago, Andrina Ingram was coming out of recovery for her chemical dependency. She had tested positive for HIV. An African-American woman, single parent, three children, living in poverty, found her way into a community of faith. And lo and behold, as she got deeper in her involvement, the Spirit began to speak to her, calling her to be a pastor. "God, you must have gotten a wrong number," she said. But the Spirit persisted. Everything about Andrina would indicate she should have been excluded, stigmatized, discriminated against. But through prayer and persistence and finding a bishop to be her advocate and lay people and a seminary faculty, she continued the journey and heeded the call. Today, she is pastor of St. Michael's Lutheran Church in Philadelphia. Can we not come to a day when the story of Andrina is not an exception, but an expectation of religious communities? Ending discrimination and stigmatization means we are committed to move from exceptions to expectations of the full participation of people living with HIV in our communities of faith. It will take, following the example of Jerusalem Lutheran Church, a member of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Kenya. A few years ago, if you would have stood up at Jerusalem Lutheran Church on a Sunday morning and identified yourself as HIV positive, people would have gotten up and walked out of the church. But that congregation struggled with the reality that such discrimination and stigmatization can't possibly reflect God's grace and mercy. And they went through the painful realities of repentance and change. Today, that's a congregation known in Nairobi as a place where people living with HIV are fully welcome to share their stories, to participate in worship and life. How are we going to get to that point? I think only if religious leaders who are heterosexual and male are willing to begin to talk vulnerably and openly about their own sexuality, rather than finding our comfort zone in talking publicly about the sexuality of persons who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgendered. as people of faith, if we're serious about ending such discrimination, we must reject the notion that human sexuality is a church-defining and therefore church-dividing issue. I don't know about you, but the last time I checked, it's the good news of Jesus Christ that defines the church. It's the good news that God saves sinners, all of us, by God's mercy through faith on account of Jesus that defines the church. And therefore, the only grounds for dividing the church should be over the question, is some other gospel being preached here than that gospel? If it's some prosperity gospel, some save yourself by your works gospel, some exclusivistic gospel, then perhaps we have grounds for dividing the church, but not human sexuality. Ending stigmatization and discrimination means we who are religious leaders, the vast majority of us being male, must break our silence, as we heard this morning, on gender-based violence. That means we need to say a clear public and private resounding no to men in our congregations and communities who are perpetrating violence in their homes and in their communities. That means that we have responsibility for creating in our worshiping communities a place where women feel safe to share their stories without fear of rejection or shaming or exclusion. And I believe we, predominantly male religious leaders, must ask one another the hard questions regarding our preaching and teaching, our reading and interpreting the scriptures, our understanding of God, our models of leadership, and how they together contribute to the continued discrimination against women and making women not only second class in society, but in our religious communities as well. If we're going to be serious as religious leaders about ending discrimination and stigmatization, we alone and together must have the courage, as Sophie challenged us, to challenge travel bans as based on no scientific fact and only based on the fact that we live in a post-9/11 orange alert state of fear in our world. We must advocate for universal access for health care, and that means starting with universal access to the health care facilities that are church-related. It means we must challenge discriminatory employment practices not only in civil society, but the employment practices and the health care benefits of those who work for our organizations, our churches. Does ending stigmatization and discrimination mean that we as a church cease to talk about morality and an ethic of responsibility? No. But I believe it means that we begin to practice what Gunnar Stolset challenged us 2 years ago in Toronto, and that is to practice an ethic of proximity. That means to take the big ethical claims, the biblical mandates, love one another, and take them down to the reality of the relationships in which we live. Jesus' command to love one another in an ethic of proximity means, Bishop Mark Hansen, love Sophie. Love the neighbor who is afraid to tell you that he is HIV positive. If we're going to end discrimination, we must resist the growing temptation in religious communities to move away from our commitment to accompanying, advocating, building awareness, responding to people living with HIV and AIDS, and focus our attention instead only on those living with malaria and TB. Let us not let the world divide our responses, but let us not also succumb to the temptation that religious people are going to find their comfort zone around diseases that do not involve human sexuality. And we must not go there. Finally, it's our own sacred scriptures that call us to end discrimination and stigmatization. You know them. We've heard them for 2 days. The sacred promise that God bestows upon every human being dignity. The promise that God is not indifferent to human suffering, but God responds out of mercy and compassion. The promise that it's God's will to restore us to community with one another and communion with God. Do we dare, we who name the name of Jesus, do we dare become as radical in our love and mercy and actions as Jesus was with Him? Jesus' radicality drove Him to refuse to live within the exclusionary boundaries that religious people of His day had created. He said, "No, I am called and I am driven and I shall sit with those you deem unholy, unclean, unwelcome. And I will not only sit with them, I will listen and forgive, heal and touch and welcome them." As Christians, when we come to the Eucharist, the meal of forgiveness and unity, let us remember that the Christ who is present there for us, who welcomes us, who forgives us, who gathers us, who sends us to be Christ's body for the life of the world, is the one whose hands bear the stigmata of exclusion and discrimination and vulnerability. It is finally by God's grace and mercy that we are called and freed to become Christ to our neighbor and to believe that Sophie and Herlin have today become Christ to us. What a sign of hope you are. What a courageous and powerful witness you are. As a religious leader, I can tell you, Sophie, I will not only seek to follow Jesus, I will try to follow Sophie. Thanks be to God.
Thank you, Bishop Hansen, for reacting as I imagine Christ would have reacted. In humbling yourself to wash the feet of Sophie and Herlin, to show respected love to them for what they've gone through. And I think in washing their feet, you've symbolically washed the feet of all people living with HIV, that the church have often excluded, stigmatized, rather than welcomed and celebrated. It was a very powerful action, and your words were very powerful as well. Sophie mentioned in her talk, we should imagine a world without stigma. Bishop Hansen said to practice the ethic of proximity. Can we be as radical as Christ? I think like this morning, this was a very moving and very powerful panel. And I would like you now to discuss around your tables how we can be as radical as Christ, how we can love our neighbor more fully than we've done in the past. What can we do as members of faith-based communities? What can religious leaders do, and what should they do to finally eradicate stigma? I'd like you to discuss that for 10 minutes and then see if you've got questions that you would like to ask or comments you would like to make. Thank you. and give people a chance to either make comments or ask questions. Okay, I know people are still interested in continuing the talk among the tables, but we'd like to continue together now. Okay, I think we've already got people here who would like to say something. Okay, can we just all be quiet now and listen? Thank you. Yes.
Thank you very much. I'm deeply moved by Bishop Mark Hansen's walking the walk and talking the talk. He has really demonstrated courage and leadership by his personal and professional vision. He dared do something that many would think that they can do, but they cannot. And if you feel the same way, please rise and join me in giving Bishop Hansen an applause. Thank you.
You better be standing and share that applause with Sophie because and my colleagues because that kind of missed the point of what I was doing. I appreciate it, but the solidarity and the commitment is going this way. I appreciate it, but I'm deflecting it. Thank you.
We'll continue the applause. Thank you very much. Are there other people who would like to share what you've discussed at the table? Yeah?
We have just learned that two blocks from here, there is a pre-conference where the HIV-positive people, not only from faith-based organizations, but from other circles of life, are gathering. I wonder if we could send a delegation from here and share what we have experienced, and that delegation be led by one or two of the bishops present in our meeting. They are just now having their plenary session, and if we really would like to move into action, let's do so.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for this suggestion. Can we do it after worship, or is that too late? Too late? So we'd have to get a little delegation together now? Is that the suggestion? Can we organize that now? Karen, would you be able to pick a few people? I think Bishop Hansen would have to be part of the team.
I'm glad to, but I think this should be led by Sophie and Herlin. I meant it at the end when I said I'm going to follow and lead. So if we do this, let's be led by folks that have led us here. And I'll be right there.
With all due respect to the bishop, I think we are discussing the role of church leaders and why they should and must change if they have not yet changed. At our table here, we said the photographs that were taken when the bishop was washing the feet of our dear sisters should be shared with all of us. And then we use our constituencies outside of this room to share that picture with other religious leaders so that that message goes out loud and clear that this is what we expect of our spiritual leaders. Because that in itself is a testimony. And we just want to appreciate, Bishop, what you have done. Don't try to be too humble about it, but we were just happy that is the way Jesus would have done what you did today. Secondly, also at our table we said, at the time of the Lord Jesus Christ, the people who were marginalized went to him. And then we asked ourselves, are our religious leaders today following the same Jesus who lived 2,000 years ago? If they are, why is it that people who are marginalized are running away from the religious leaders of today and yet the same category of people were running towards Jesus 2,000 years ago. Thank you very much. Those are some of the things that we shared at our table.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Sorry, I can't. Yes. Okay. I think we'll wait till this session is over so that at 6 o'clock, as we start worship, a little delegation can go over. Is that okay? Because I think that'll be easier to organize. Yeah?
I just wanted to...
Thank
you.
The lights, yeah.
Christo Greling and myself from the network INRELA, the International Network of Religious Leaders Living with or Personally Affected by HIV and AIDS, would be privileged to join a delegation like that, both as religious leaders and people living with HIV.
Thank you. Are there any other comments, questions?
At our table, we were all very humbled by that act of compassion. And we asked, why are there no more bishops on their knees, as we saw today? Mm-hmm. And how do we get more bishops on their knees, as we saw today? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. A good question. Yes, at the back there.
As a person living with HIV virus, I've really seen humility in Bishop because of the harsh environment that I've gone through. On our table, we said there should be change of attitude. There should be education, more education to our leadership. That is the spiritual leaders. And I tend to say that I don't know whether all the leaderships have a calling or some are on employment. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm not quite sure whether I got your last point about the employment. But I think it could also be a plea for pastors, for church ministers, to work more closely with INRELA, with EHIA, with people who really want to educate clergy better on HIV issues, and who work with positive clergy, because I think that makes a huge difference.
I just wanted to say, I don't want to speak about the table where I'm on, but 2 years ago in Soweto, in Johannesburg, there was in the biggest church of Johannesburg, Regina Mundi, was a meeting where all the 23 Roman Catholic bishops of South Africa were present. There was a congregation of about 10,000 people, and they have anointed 150 people with HIV who wanted to be anointed. And one was outstanding. It was Bishop Laurence Henry of Cape Town. And after anointing the people he had to anoint, he hugged them, he kissed them, and put his arms around him. So I think that was also very, very beautiful. So it's very good what Bishop Hanson did, but it's not the only one in the world. But these people are examples. Mm-hmm. And I would say if a delegation goes to the people living with HIV/AIDS, if they just hug them and kiss them, I think then it's all right.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We'll have one more, and then we'll close this session.
Jussara,
I have now a moment of reconciliation because what happened right now, especially when this person started talking about the person's rights and now not the citizen's rights, but the person's rights. And that scene that I saw, I have never seen something similar. So as a moment of reconciliation, so I want this delegation to join this message of human beings.
Thank you. I would like to really say a very, very sincere thanks to all three panelists. I think all of you have really shared a lot, have done a lot, and have really been very Christ-like in your approach and have really made a deep impression on all of us. And as someone has said, we wished there were more bishops like that. We wished that all religious leaders would act like that, and we'd have a different world. We'd have a world without stigma in the churches. And so we hope that many will follow your example, Bishop Hansen. And also thank you so much, Sophie, for sharing, and Emilio, for your words as well. Thank you, everyone.